Then she stood up and looked at the ocean. "Julie's gone," she said. "I am Miax now." She leaped lightly up the bank and onto the tundra. Her stride opened wider and wider, for she was on her way to San Francisco. Part 3. Capuchin, the Hunter. The memories vanished. The wind screamed, "Ooh-wee." Miax touched the lichens on the top of her frost heave. "Amarok," she called again, then ran down the slope and climbed to the wolf den. The site was silent and eerie, and the puppy's playground was speckled with bleached bones like tombstones in a graveyard. She picked one up and saw that it was jagged with the marks of little teeth. With some carving, it could be made into the comb she had been wanting. Glancing around, she saw the club-like base of an antler. "A weapon," she said. "I may need it." A snowy owl floated past, turning his head as he peered down at her curiously. "I'll see you in San Francisco," she called. He set his eyes on some distant goal, bowed his wings, and flew southward as silently as the shadow he cast. The wind twisted a strand of her hair, and as she stood on the wolf hill, she felt the presence of the great animals she had lived with. Amarok, Nails, Silver, Capu. She wondered if she would ever see them again. The wind gusted. She turned and walked slowly back home, trailing her fingers on the tips of the sedges and thinking about her departure. At the top of her frost heave, she froze in her tracks. Her house was crushed in, and her sleeping skins were torn and strewn over the grass. The meat she had laid out on the grass was gone. Her icebox was opened and empty. "Ayee!" she cried. "My food! My life! I'm dead!" Running from broken house to dumped cooking pot to icebox, she felt needles of fear move up her spine, spread into her arms, and pierce her whole body. Who had done this? What bestial creature had taken her food? She looked desperately around and saw, crouched in the reeds, almost beside her, the angry Jello. His tail was swishing slowly. His ears were forward. She understood his message and stepped back. Then she knew that was wrong. She mustn't give in. Hand tightening on the antler club, brandishing it, growling, she flung herself upon him and bit the top of his nose. His eyes widened, his ears and body drooped, and his tail went between his legs. He groveled on his belly and came up to her, smiling, head lowered humbly. Desperate, furious, she lunged at him. Jello rolled to his back and flashed the white hair of surrender. She didn't strike. She couldn't strike a coward. "Jello," she cried, "why? Why did you do it?" Holding him in abeyance with the antler, she glanced around the ruins of her home and took stock of the damage. All the food in the cellar and on the ground was gone, and her pack wasn't in sight. Brandishing her weapon, growling at Jello, she backed toward the sod house, kicked back the ruins, and saw the pack under the crushed roof. It was intact. Jello hadn't found the meat in it. Her mind raced. She had a little food, and Capu had told her that the Lennings were coming back. She could yet make it.
"Gnarl,"
she snapped at Jello and lowered her club. He rolled over, stood up, and, tail between his legs, fled into the twilight. When he was gone, she stood for a long time. Finally, she picked up her sleeping skin and tore a fiber from the new hide. She got out her needle and sitting with her legs out straight in the manner of Eskimo women, began to sew. A lemming ran across a lichen patch. She stopped working and watched the little animal add a mouthful of grass to its round nest. A movement caught her eye, and she glanced up to see a least weasel washing his belly on the other side of the knoll. New white fur was splashed across his gold back. He finished his toilet, and when he sat down, he disappeared under the reindeer moss. "You're tiny," she said, and smiled. Another cycle was beginning. The animals who preyed on the lemmings were also coming back. Miax put her needle away, rolled her ground skin into a tight bundle, and tied it to the bottom of the pack. Then she got her pot and sleeping skin, her ulo and man's knife, the bones, and her flowers. She packed them, tied a thong to the new caribou skin so she could drag it behind her, and lined up her pointer stones with a distant frost heave. "It's time to go," she said, and walked away, not looking back. Many hours later, she opened her pack, spread her skins, and took out a strand of smoked meat. A snowshoe hare screamed, and, recognizing the cry of death, Miax picked up her club and ran off to take the rabbit from its killer. Rounding a clump of grass, she came upon an enormous wolverine, the king of the Arctic weasel family. Slowly he lifted his head. The wolverine was built low to the ground, and his powerful front feet were almost as big as a man's hand. Utterly fearless, he looked her in the face. "Shoo!" she said, and jumped at him. He left the rabbit and came toward her. She jumped back and raised her club. He leapt lightly to the side, snarled, and sauntered away. Gingerly she snatched the hare, turned, and fled back to camp. The wolverine's fearlessness sent goosebumps up her spine. Hastily throwing the hare on the caribou skin she was dragging for just such a purpose, she walked on. A tern floated past. She took out her sinew, held her arm under the bird, and singing aloud strode toward Point Hope. At sunset, the clouds were dark and soft-edged, like bears. They could dump a foot of snow or a sprinkle of snow. She dug a niche in the side of a heave with her man's knife, folded her ground skin into an envelope, and pushed it into the cave. With deft hands, she pressed her sleeping skin into the envelope, then undressed. The fur nestled her, and when each toe and finger was warm, she peered solemnly out of her den. The sky darkened, the clouds lowered, and the wind blew like a charging buck. In less than a minute, she could see no more than the fur around her face. The snow had come. Buried in her skins like an animal in its lair, Miax wondered about Amarok and Kapu. Would they be curled in furry balls, or would they be running joyously through the first storm of the winter, following their noses to game? When she awoke, the sun was out, the sky was clear, and only a feathering of snow covered the tundra, just enough to make it winter. Before she had dressed, however, the crystals had melted, all but a few on the north sides of the slopes that spoke of things to come. Miax pulled a snarl out of her hair with her fingers, then looked around. Someone was watching her. Running to the top of a low hill, she scanned the flatness. A dozen stout caribou, their white necks gleaming in the sunlight, browsed in the distance, but there was nothing else. She laughed at herself, went back to her camp, and ate a piece of smoked meat. Rolling her skins and shouldering her pack, she walked to her caribou skin to pick up the leads. It was empty. Someone had taken her rabbit in the night. A wolverine, she thought, but there wasn't a footstep to tell which way the thief had gone. She spun around. Again she felt as if someone were watching her. Again there was no one. There was only a large flock of terns in the sky. Taking a bearing on them with her sinew and adjusting her pack, she gave the skin drag a yank and walked on. All day the birds moved overhead. She walked a straight line to the ocean, for the pools had frozen, and she could follow her compass without deviating. When the eerie feeling of being watched persisted, Miax began to wonder if the vast nothingness was driving her mad, as it did many Gussaks. To occupy her mind, she sang as she gathered caribou droppings and put them on her drag. Amarok, Wolf, my friend, you are my adopted father. My feet shall run because of you. My heart shall beat because of you. And I shall love because of you. That evening she stopped early, built a bright fire, and cooked a stew, adding to it a sweet leather lichen from the tundra. While the pot simmered and the steam hung above it like a gray spirit, she took out a needle and thread and mended a hole in her old mitten. The earth trembled. She glanced up to see two of the largest caribou she had ever beheld. She could tell by the massiveness of their antlers that they were males, for those of the females are more slender and shorter. As the two ran side by side, the gleam of their headpieces told her it was the breeding season of the caribou. When the last fuzzy antler coating of summer is rubbed off and the horns glow and shimmer, the mating season begins, a season of bellowing and short tempers. Suddenly, the lead bull circled and came toward the other. Both lowered their heads and clashed antlers with a clanging crack that sounded like a shot. Neither was hurt. They shook their heads and stepped back, tossed their antlers, and bellowed. Colliding again, they pawed the ground, and then peacefully trotted away. Miax wondered who they were fighting over, for not a female was to be seen. All the bravado and glamour seemed lost on the grass and the sky. Nevertheless, when she had eaten, she picked up her pack, tugged on her cumbersome drag, and moved on, for the thundering animals told her she was along the migration path, and she didn't want to camp in the middle of a caribou love nest. Far from the herd, she stopped by a pond and made her bed. She wasn't sleepy, so she took out the wolf puppy bone and, holding the ulo between her knees, carved a tooth in the comb. Orange and purple shadows crept over the land as the sun went down that night, and Miax crawled into her sleeping skin, noting that the days were growing shorter. She felt restless like the birds and mammals, and in the middle of the night she awakened and peered out at the sky. A star twinkled in the half-lit dome. The first of the year. She smiled, sat up, and hugged her knees. The guidepost of her ancestors, the North Star, would soon be visible and would point her way when the birds had all gone south. Softly across the distance, a wolf barked, then another. The first bark was one of inquiry, a sort of, "Where are you, and what are you doing?" The answer was a casual, "I'm here." The next call, however, was disquieting. The wolf seemed to be saying there was danger in the air. Miax looked around to see what it might be. Then the wolf changed the subject and shifted to a joyous howl. As the others joined in, she recognized the hunt song of her pack. Amarok's rich tones rose and fell like a violin. Then came the flute-like voice of Silver. Nail's voice arose, less strong than Amarok's, bringing variation to the theme. Cupping her hands behind her ears, she listened intently. Yes, the pups were singing too, sounding very mature and grown up, until Kapu added his laugh bark. She listened for Jello to sound forth. He didn't. The concert ended abruptly, and she heard other sounds in the dimness. A lemming screamed in death, and a flock of migrating eider ducks called out their positions to each other. Suddenly something moved. She bolted out of bed and grabbed her club. The grass crackled behind her, and she spun around. Sedges bobbed to say it was only the wind. Aye! She was disgusted by her fears. She kicked a stone to change something, since she couldn't change what she was doing, as Capuchin advised. Feeling better, she slid back in her sleeping skin. I guess, she said to herself, that the sun's been up so long, I've forgotten the sounds of the night. As she waited for sleep, she listened to the polar wind whistle, and the dry grasses whined like the voice of the old bent lady. Jello! She screamed, sitting bolt upright. He was almost beside her, his teeth bared as he growled. Then he picked up her pack and ran. She jumped out of bed and started after him, for her very life was in that pack. Food, needles, knives, even her boots. The wind chilled her naked body, and she stopped to collect her wits. She must act with wisdom. She must think. Her clothes. Where were her clothes? They, too, were gone. No. She remembered they were safe in the bladder bag under the caribou skin. Quickly she pulled them out and clutched them to her chest. But they were of little comfort. She could go nowhere without boots. Nor could she make new ones. Her needles and ulo, the tools of survival, were all in the pack. Shivering, she slid into bed and cried. A tear fell on the grass and froze solid. My tombstone. She lay very still, wondering how long it would take for life to leave her. When she opened her eyes, it was daylight, and the warm yellow of the land gave her hope. She could eat her caribou skin if she had to. Rolling to her stomach, she smelled something sweet and recognized the scent of wolf urine. It had been dropped at the edge of her bag and was frozen but fresh. Someone had greeted her during the night. It couldn't have been Jello, for the scent didn't have the bitter odor of an angry and desolate wolf. Furthermore, it was sparsely given, not the dousing given to hostile objects. It must have been Amarok. She sniffed again, but her nose wasn't sensitive enough to read the other messages in the urine that meant all is well. Yet its light and loving scent gave her a sense of security, and she smiled at the sun, dressed, and put her mind to inventing boots. Wrapping the drag around one foot and her sleeping skin around the other, she clomped awkwardly through the grass in a wider and wider circle, hoping that Jello, having eaten her meat, would have abandoned the pack. She didn't care about the food anymore. Her ulo and needles and matches were more important to find. With them, she could make shoes, hunt, and cook. She marveled at how valuable these simple things were, how beautiful and precious. With them, she could make a home, a larder, a sled, and clothes. And the cold air was equally precious. With it, she could, like her father, freeze leather and sinew into sleds, spears, and harpoons. She wouldn't die here if she could find her ulo and needles. As she carefully searched the ground, she began to think about seal camp. The old Eskimos were scientists, too. By using the plants, animals, and temperature, they had changed the harsh Arctic into a home, a feat as incredible as sending rockets to the moon. She smiled. The people at seal camp hadn't been as outdated and old-fashioned as she had been led to believe. No, on the contrary, they had been wise. They had adjusted to nature instead of to man-made gadgets. "Aye!" she gasped. On the side of a groundswell lay Jell-O, his body torn in bloody shreds, his face contorted. Beside him lay her backpack. Instantly she knew what had happened. Amarok had turned on him. Once Capuchin had told her that some wolves had tolerated a lone wolf until the day he stole meat from the pups. With that, the leader gave a signal, and his pack turned, struck, and tore the lone wolf to pieces. "There's no room in the wolf society for an animal who can't contribute," he had said. Jell-O had been so cowed he was useless, and now he was dead. Slowly she opened her pack. The food was gone, but her needles, ulo, and boots were tucked in the pockets where she had put them. They were now more wonderful to Miaks than airplanes, ocean liners, and great wide bridges. As she put on her shoes, she checked for her man's knife and matches. They were there, too. Life was hers again. Slinging her pack to her shoulders, she placed a stone at Jell-O's head and turned away. "You've got to be a super wolf to live," she said. Poor Jell-O was not. She left him to the Jaegers and foxes. "Amarok, wolf, my friend," she sang as she walked along. "Amarok, my adopted father." Reaching Point Hope seemed less important now that she had come to truly understand the value of her ulo and needles. If she missed the boat, she could live well until another year. Her voice rang out happily as she sang and followed the birds and her compass. One evening, as she looked for a campsite, she felt lonely. To amuse herself, she thought of the hill where the White House stood in San Francisco. When it seemed almost real enough to touch, and very beautiful, it vanished abruptly, for the tundra was even more beautiful, a glistening gold, and its shadows were purple and blue. Lemon-yellow clouds sailed a green sky, and every wind-tossed sedge was a silver thread. "Oh," she whispered in awe, and stopped where she was to view the painted earth. As she dropped her pack, it clanged out a frozen note, reminding her again that autumn was over. The season had been brief. The flash of bird wings, the thunder of migrating herds, that was all. Now it was winter, and the top of the soil was solid. No blue sea would be lapping the shores of Barrow. Instead, the Arctic Ocean would be a roaring white cauldron, forming icebergs that would join the land with the polar cap. She wasn't afraid. Singing her Amarok song, she gathered grass and rolled it into cylinders. With deft strokes, she chopped a hole in the ice-bound lake, soaked the grass sticks, and laid them out in the air to freeze. Hours later, they had snapped and crackled into ice poles. She cut the drag in two pieces, and, pushing the poles under one piece, she erected a tent. Inside her shelter, she cut a long thread of hide and twisted it into a snare. A snowshoe rabbit trail ran along the lake, and she set off to find the resting place of the one who had made it. The air was cold, and she blew her breath into the wolverine trim of her parka hood. There it hung, and warmed her face. Amarok called, and she called back, not to tell him she needed food, as she had once done, but to tell him where she was. A lemming burst out of the grass near her foot, and she spun around to look for its nest and young. Not finding them, she turned back in time to see a fox ripple like a ribbon as he pounced and sped off with the lemming. She grinned, made a mental note to be quicker, and walked carefully along the rabbit trail. Finally she came upon a concave dish in the ground, the roost. In it, the rabbit would hide from enemies or rest when not eating. She spread her snare elevated it with an ice stick, and paid out enough hideline to be out of the sight of the hare. Flat on her stomach, she watched the roost. Minutes turned into hours, and the pinks and greens of sunset colored the frozen prairie. Suddenly, down the trail, ears back, feet flying, came the rabbit. It made a sharp turn and plopped to a halt in its roost. Miax yanked and caught its left hind foot. She killed it quickly and ran back to camp. The grass rustled, and she turned around. Kapu! He was trotting down the rabbit trail with a leg of caribou in his mouth. His head bucked as he fought the awkward weight of the meat. Kapu, she repeated. He wagged his tail, took a better grip on his burden, and trotted up to her. He dropped it at her feet. With a skip and a leap, she told him in wolf language how glad she was to see him. He replied by dashing around in a small circle, then in three big circles. Finally he stopped and wagged his tail. "Is this for me?" she asked, pointing to the leg. He spanked the ground with his front paw, leaped to the side, and spanked the ground again. With a grin, she reached in her pocket, found a strip of caribou hide, and thrust it at him. Kapu snatched it, and with one pull not only wrested it from her, but sent her sprawling on her back. Tail held straight out, he streaked like a rocket across the lichens, turned, and came back with the hide. He shook it in front of her, daring her to take it away. "You're much, much too strong for me now, Kapu," she said, and slowly got to her feet. "I can't play with you anymore." Shaking the hide, he danced, barked, and then ran over the tundra until he was but a speck in the distance. Miax laughed and dragged the caribou leg back to her tent. She cut it up and built a small fire. She skinned the rabbit, saving the fur to line her new mitten. As the stew cooked, the crackling cold inspired her to dance. She stepped forward on the vast stage at the top of the world and bowed to her immense audience. Curving her arms out, bending her knees, she hopped on one foot and beat time with the other. Then she glided and shifted her weight, gracefully executing a combination of steps which the bent woman had danced long ago at seal camp. When she came to the refrain, however, she didn't do the dance about evil spirits, but improvised, as Eskimos do at this point. She told the story of a young wolf who had brought the lost girl a shank of meat, and ended the performance with a kapu-like caper. She spun laughing to a stop. She was warm. Her blood tingled. "Eli," she thought, "the old Eskimo customs aren't so foolish. They have purpose. I'm as warm as the center of a lemming's nest." As the sky darkened, Kapu came back. He barked softly. "I know what you want," she called, holding out a large piece of cooked meat. Kapu took it so gently from her fingers that she couldn't even feel his teeth. As she watched him run off into the night, her eyes lifted to the sky. There, twinkling in the distance, was the North Star, the permanent light that had guided the Eskimos for thousands of years. She sang, "Bright star, still star, lead me to the sea." Hastily, she cut the remaining half of her caribou skin into four strips and a circle. Crackling open the ice on the lake, she weighted the pieces with stones and sent them to the bottom. Around midnight, she awoke to hear her wolves in the distance talking softly among themselves, probably paying tribute to Amarok as they moved along the trail, she thought. Peering out of her tent, she saw that the star was gone. A cold flake struck her nose, melted, fell into her fur, and froze. The wind blared, the wolves called joyously, and Miak snuggled deep in her furs. Let it snow. Kapu had known it was coming and had brought food for her. She slept until daybreak, saw that it was still snowing, and dozed off and on through the white, wild day, as the weasels and foxes did. That night the sky cleared, and at dawn she crawled out of her skins. The tundra was white with the snow that would lock up the Arctic till June. The cold had deepened. After breakfast, she cracked open the lake ice again, pulled out the water-soaked circle, and laid it out on the ground. Using her man's knife, she turned up the edges, tied them in place, and let the cup freeze in the air. As it hardened, she stepped into the bottom, tramped it into a bowl, and then cut two holes in one side. Through these she ran leather thongs and tied them together. Next she took two strips of skin from the water and held them in place while they froze to the bottom of the bowl in the shape of flat rockers. Then she stood up. Her sled was done. Working quickly, for she had only a few hours of daylight, she formed tear-shaped hoops out of the last two strips. These she laid out to freeze. When they were solid, she webbed them with hide, made loops for her toes, and put on her snowshoes. They crackled and snapped, but kept her up on the drifts. Now she could travel the top of the snow. She cut the rest of the caribou leg into bite-sized chunks and stored them in her sled. Then, adjusting her mittens in the darkness, she took a bearing on the North Star and started off. Her icy sled jingled over the wind-swept lakes, and she sang as she traveled. The stars grew brighter as the hours passed, and the tundra began to glow, for the snow reflected each twinkle a billion times over, turning the night to silver. By this light, she could see the footsteps of the wolves. She followed them, for they were going her way. Just before sunrise, the wolf prints grew closer together. They were slowing down for the sleep. She felt their presence everywhere, but couldn't see them. Running out on a lake, she called. Shadows flickered on the top of a frost heave. There they were. She quickened her stride. She would camp with them and do the dance of the wolf pup feeding the lost girl for Kapu. He would surely run in circles when he saw it. The shadows flattened as she walked, and by the time she reached the other shore, they had turned into sky and vanished. There were no footsteps in the snow to say her pack had been there, and she knew the Arctic dawn had tricked her eyes. "Frost spirits," she said, as she pitched her tent by the lake and crawled into bed. By the yellow-green light of the low noon sun, Miak could see that she had camped on the edge of the wintering grounds of the caribou. Their many gleaming antlers formed a forest on the horizon. Such a herd would certainly attract her pack. She crawled out of bed and saw that she had pitched her tent in a tiny forest about 3 inches high. Her heart pounded excitedly, for she hadn't seen one of these willow groves since Nunavak. She was making progress, for they grew, not near Barrow, but in slightly warmer and wetter lands near the coast. She smelled the air in the hopes that it bore the salty odor of the ocean, but it smelled only of the cold. The dawn cracked and hummed, and the snow was so fine that it floated above the ground when a breeze stirred. Not a bird passed overhead. The buntings, longspurs, and terns were gone from the top of the world. A willow ptarmigan, the chicken of the tundra, clucked behind her and whistled softly as it hunted seeds. The Arctic Circle had been returned to its permanent bird resident, the hardy ptarmigan. The millions of voices of summer had died down to one plaintive note.
"Aha! Aha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha!"
Miak sat up, wondering what that was. Creeping halfway out of her bag, she peered into the sky to see a great brown bird maneuver its wings and speed west. A skua! She was closer to the ocean than she thought, for the skua is a bird of the coastal waters of the Arctic. As her eyes followed it, they came to rest on an oil drum, the signpost of American civilization in the north. How excited she would have been to see this a month ago. Now she wasn't so sure. She had her ulo and needles, her sled and her tent, and the world of her ancestors. And she liked the simplicity of that world. It was easy to understand. Out here, she understood how she fitted into the scheme of the moon and stars and the constant rise and fall of life on the earth. Even the snow was part of her. She melted it and drank it. Amarok barked. He sounded as if he was no more than a quarter of a mile away. "Ow, ow," she called. Nails answered, and then the whole pack howled briefly. "I'm over here," she shouted joyously, jumping up and down. "Here by the lake." She paused. "You know that. You know everything about me all the time." The wind began to rise as the sun started back to the horizon. The lake responded with a boom that sounded like a pistol shot. The freeze was deepening. Miax lit a fire and put on her pot. A warm stew would taste good, and the smoke and flames would make the tundra home. Presently, Amarok barked forcefully, and the pack answered. Then the royal voice sounded from another position, and Silver checked in from across the lake. Nails gave a warning snarl, and the pups whispered in woofs. Miak shaded her eyes. Her wolves were barking from points around a huge circle, and she was in the middle. This was strange. They almost always stayed together. Suddenly Amarok barked ferociously, his voice angry and authoritative. Silver yelped, then Nails and Kapu. They had something at bay. She stepped onto the lake and skipped toward them. Halfway across, she saw a dark head rise above the hill, and a beast with a head as large as the moon rose to its hind feet, massive paws swinging. "Grizzly," she gasped, and stopped stone still as the huge animal rushed onto the ice. Amarok and Nails leapt at its face and sprang away before the bear could strike. They were heading it off, trying to prevent it from crossing. The bear snarled, lunged forward, and galloped toward Miax. She ran toward her tent. The wind was in her face, and she realized she was upwind of the bear, her scent blowing right to him. She darted off in another direction, for bears have poor eyesight and can't track if they can't smell. Slipping and sliding, she reached the south bank as the grizzly staggered forward, then crumpled to its knees and sat down. She wondered why he wasn't in hibernation. The wolves had been sleeping all day. They couldn't have wakened the bear. She sniffed the air to try to smell the cause, but only odorless ice crystals stung her nose. The pack kept harassing the sleepy beast, barking and snarling, but with no intention of killing it. They were simply trying to drive it away. Away from her, she realized. Slowly the bear got to its feet and permitted itself to be herded up the lake bank and back to where it had come from. Reluctantly, blindly, it staggered before the wolves. Occasionally it stood up like a giant, but mostly it roared in the agony of sleepiness. Yapping, barking, darting, the wolves drove the grizzly far out on the tundra. Finally they veered away and, breaking into a joyous gallop, dashed over the snow and out of sight. Their duty done, they were running, not to hunt, not to kill, but simply for fun. Miax was trembling. She hadn't realized the size and ferocity of the dark bear of the north, who is called grizzly inland, and brown bear along the coasts, Ursus arctos. Large ones, like the grizzly her wolves had driven away, weighed over 1,000 pounds and stood 9 feet tall when they reared. Miax wiped a bead of perspiration from her forehead. Had he come upon her tent, with one curious sweep of his paw, he would have snuffed out her life while she slept. "Amarok! Nails! Kapu!" she called. "I thank you! I thank you!" As she packed to travel on, she thought about her escorts. Wolves didn't like civilization. Where they had once dwelled all over North America, they now lived in remote parts of Canada, in only 2 of the lower 48 states, and in the wilderness of Alaska. Even the roadless North Slope had fewer wolves than it did before the Gussaks erected their military bases and brought airplanes, snowmobiles, electricity, and jeeps to the Arctic. As she thought about the Gussaks, she suddenly knew why the brown bear was awake. The Americans' hunting season had begun. Her wolves were in danger. The Gussaks were paid to shoot them. A man who brought in the left ear of a wolf to the warden was rewarded with a bounty of $50. The bounty was evil to the old men at Seal Camp, for it encouraged killing for money rather than need. Kapugen considered the bounty the Gussaks' way of deciding that the Amaroks couldn't live on this earth anymore. "And no men have that right," he would say. "When the wolves are gone, there will be too many caribou grazing the grass, and the lemmings will starve. Without the lemmings, the foxes and birds and weasels will die. Their passing will end smaller lives upon which even man depends, whether he knows it or not, and the top of the world will pass into silence." Miax was worried. The oil drum she had seen when the Skua flew over marked the beginning of civilization and the end of the wilderness. She must warn her pack of the danger ahead. She had learned to say many things to them, but now, the most important of all, the ear twist or bark that would turn them back, she did not know. "How," she thought, "do I shout, 'Go away, go far, far away?'" She sang, "Go away, royal wolf, go away, do not follow. I'm a gun at your head when I pass the oil drum." Threads of clouds spun up from the earth and trailed across the tundra. They marked the beginning of a whiteout. Miax changed her plans to travel that night, crept into her shelter, and watched the air turn white as the snow arose from the ground and hung all around her. She closed her tent flap and took out her pot. In it, she put a piece of fat from the bladder bag and a scrap of sinew. She lit the sinew, and a flame illuminated her tiny home. She took out the comb. As she carved, she saw that it wasn't a comb at all, but Amarok. The teeth were his legs, the handle his head. He was waiting to be released from the bone. Surprised to see him, she carved carefully for hours, and finally she let him out. His neck was arched, his head and tail were lifted. Even his ears had a message. "I love you," they said. A bird called faintly in the darkness. Miax wondered what kind it was, and what it was doing so far north at this date. Too sleepy to think, she unlaced her boots, undressed, and folded her clothes. The bird called from the edge of her sleeping skin. Holding her candle above her head, she crept toward the door and peered into the bright eyes of a golden plover. He was young, for he wore the splotched plumage of the juvenile and still had a trace of baby yellow around his beak. He slumped against her skins. Gently, she slipped her hand under his feet, picked him up, and brought him close to her. His black and gold feathers gleamed in the sputtering light. She had never beheld a plover so closely, and now understood why Capuchin had called them the spirit of the birds. The plover's golden eye and red noseband made it look like one of the dancers in the bladder feast. "You're lost," she said. "You should be far from here. Perhaps in Labrador. Perhaps even in your winter home on the plains of Argentina. And so you're dying. You need insects and meat. But I'm so glad you're here." Then she added, "I shall call you Tornate, the bird spirit." She eased the bird inside her warm sleeping skin, cut off a small piece of caribou meat, and held it out. Tornate ate ravenously, then rested. She fed him once more, and then he tucked his head in his back feathers and went to sleep. The following night, the whiteout was still so dense she couldn't see the ground when she crept out for snow to melt and drink. "I won't go on tonight," she said to Tornate when she came inside. "But I don't care. I have food, light, furs, fire, and a pretty companion." That evening, she polished her carving of Amarok and talked to Tornate. The plover was incredibly tame, perhaps because he lived in the most barren parts of the world where there were no men, perhaps because he was lonely. Tornate ran over her skins, flitted to her head and shoulders, and sang when she sang. On the next afternoon, the whiteout was but a frosty mist. Miax was cooking dinner when Tornate drew his feathers to his body and stood up in alarm. She listened for a long time before she heard the snow scream as footsteps pressed it. Scrambling to the door, she saw Capu in the mist, frost on his whiskers. "Hi," she called. He didn't look around, for he was looking at something in the distance. Presently, Amarok swept into view and stopped beside him. "Amarok," she shouted. "Amarok, how are you?" Tossing her head in wolf happiness, she crawled out of her tent on all fours and nudged him under the chin. He arched his neck grandly. Then, with a glance at Capu, he ran out on the lake. The young wolf followed, and laughing joyously, Miax crawled after them both. She hadn't gone far before Amarok stopped and glared at her. She stayed where she was. The regal pair leaped away, snow billowing up from their strides like smoke. Getting to her knees, she looked for Silver, Nails, and the other pups, but they didn't follow the pair. Miax rocked back on her heels. Could it be that the leader of the pack was teaching the leader of the pups? She nodded slowly as she comprehended. Of course. To be a leader required not only fearlessness and intelligence, but experience and schooling. The head of a wolf pack needed to be trained, and who better to do this than Amarok? "And I know what you'll teach," she called out. "You'll teach him which animal to harvest. You'll teach him to make all decisions. You'll teach him how to close in on a caribou and where to bed the wolf pack down. And you'll teach him to love and protect." The whiteout vanished, the stars blazed out, and San Francisco called to Miax. It was time to move on. Capu was now in school. "But how shall I tell them not to follow me anymore?" she asked Tornate as she crawled back into her tent. "Of course," she gasped. She had been told by Amarok himself how to say "stay back" when he had wanted Capu alone. He had walked forward, turned around, and glared into her eyes. She had stopped in her tracks and gone home. Eagerly she practiced. She ran forward, looked over her shoulder, and glared. "Stay, Amarok. Stay where you are." Humming to herself, she took down her tent rolled it into a bundle, and threw it on the new sled. Then she stuffed her pack and tucked Tornate in the hood of her parka. Sticking her toes in her snowshoes, she took a bearing on the constant star. The snow squeaked under her feet, and for the first time she felt the dry bite of the cold right through her parka and boots. To her, this meant the temperature was zero, the point every year when she began to feel chilly. Dancing and swinging her arms to get warm, she picked up the thongs of her sled and walked toward the sea. The sled glided lightly behind her. She didn't hear the airplane. She saw it. The low sun of noon struck its aluminum body, and it sparkled like a star in the sky. It was a small plane, the type bush pilots use to carry people over the roadless tundra and across the rugged mountains of Alaska, where cars can't go. Presently, its sound reached her ears, and the throb of the engines reminded her that this was the beginning of the season when bush pilots took the gussaks out to hunt. The craft tipped its wings and zigzagged across the sky. When it continued to zag, she realized the pilot was following a meandering river where game wintered. A river, she thought. Rivers led to the sea. I'm nearing the end of my journey. Point Hope might be but one sleep away. She quickened her pace. The airplane banked, turned, and came toward her. It seemed as big as an eagle as it skimmed low over the ground. Bright flashes of fire burst from its side. "They are hunting," she said to Tornate. "Let's get in the oil drum. I look like a bear in these clothes." Just before she reached the drum, she crossed the footsteps of Amarok and Kapu. They had passed this way only moments ago, for the snow crystals their warm feet had melted were not yet frozen again. The plane continued to come toward her. Apparently she had been seen. She kicked snow over her sled and pack and crawled to the front of the barrel. It was sealed. She couldn't get inside. Scurrying to the other end, she found that it, too, was closed. Desperately, she threw herself under the curve of the drum and lay still. Much of her was still exposed. Flailing her hands and feet, she stirred up the light snow. It arose like a cloud and settled upon her as the plane soared above. Shots rang out. The plane roared away, and Miak's opened her eyes. She was still alive, and the air hunters were over the river. The plane banked.